session number 30304.
Tadarina, reel 27.
Well, 90 minutes, or thereabouts, as I remember it, had passed since cloud and darkness forced this forbidding return on us at the end of a memorable day. And Jackie had just obtained his 72nd QDM, a record then unsurpassed, I'm sure, and one to be shared with the ground radio operator, when our second wireless operator tapped me on the shoulder. From time to time, he'd been looking into the ASV radar screen as an ever optimistic but unlikely check against trouble ahead. He must have had a pretty miserable time up to that point, I think. And then he said, "They said the radar beacon at Reykjavik will be starting to transmit soon." He said, "I think I've got it on the ASV set. It's on the port beam." And he asked Jackie N. to check it with him. They both turned to me in delight. "That's it," they yelled, amidst enthusiastic whoops, which I won't repeat. And giving them the thumbs up, I nudged Smithy and pointed down below. "Can Nav tell us where we are?" He came back with the answer I'd hoped for. "About 40 miles from Reykjanes and DF station and 30 from Reykjavik airport." "What does the ASV make it to the WOP?" "30 miles to port," he replied. "I can probably give you distance about every 5 miles, perhaps less when you turn directly onto it." I needed no second bidding. I remember as I turned, I was quite sure that the gremlins which had been dancing on the windscreen fell off. Jackie shook, good old Jackie shook his tapping hand and flexed his fingers. I can see him now. After his long stint, he was a passenger now, as were the others, apart from the ASV operator, head to the viewing funnel, calling the tune in his unexpected role as the final saviour. It went something like this, or so they say. I remember it well. 25 miles ahead. Silence in the cockpit as the crew watched, then looked ahead for any sign giving hope of a safe approach. 22 miles starboard. I corrected. 20 ahead, 15 to starboard, again I corrected, and began to allow for an obvious drift. 12 ahead, 10, I started to descend from 700 feet at 100 feet a minute. 8 miles, 7, 5, 4, we were down to 500 feet and still in cloud. 3 miles, then suddenly halo lights appeared ahead, increasingly bright as we slowly sank through the last thin drizzly layers of clinging overcast. The runway floodlight went on. On the far side of the airfield we could see the red warning light, which was halfway up the local radio mast. We couldn't see the top light. I don't know where it was. No, I do, actually. The light on the top of it was somewhere up in the clouds. Cheering on board subsided a little as I put the Hudson into a tight circuit which hardly extended beyond the aerodrome boundary. There was little enough time to get the wheels down, flaps down, approach speed, and landing lights down before we and the aircraft were down, rolling along the runway precisely 17:44 hours, having responded promptly to the instruction to return to base, or Reykjavik, immediately upon receipt of the message. The squadron commander rang through from Calder with a, "Well done, but why did it take so long?" After the legitimate explanation, I gave him some idea of the terrific response of the crew when I said they'd decided that nothing, not even the Icelandic weather, should stop the award of our blue nose certificates. After all, it's the point of enduring an Iceland posting without taking one home. I think it was, in fact, the first in the use of radar in such conditions. Bully for them. Back at Canadarnis in the worst of December's gales, when the wind speed reached 120 miles an hour, the roof of the electricity generating station was blown off, the equipment damaged, and leaving us without electricity during the one of the shortest days of the year.
Can we talk a little bit about the weather that you experienced, or the extremes of weather that you could experience, Ted? So you've mentioned a little bit of it, obviously, in the flight, but what kind of things would be different that you would experience over Iceland or on Iceland that are different from, say, the UK?
Not all that different, actually. In the sense that Reykjavik, of course, being at sea level, subject to the so-called warming waters of the Gulf, the Gulf Stream drift. It was a harbour, a place, an airfield, open most, I would say, virtually all through the year. And, of course, the flights were mainly over water, flights that we made. The only time I and one or two others, my immediate friends, ventured into Iceland countryside, if you can call it that, was when we went to try our skill, or lack of it, very much lack of it, at skiing. And there was a place about 30 miles up near a frozen lake. It was remarkable only because we had seen a little more of Iceland as it actually was rather than from the air, but certainly we didn't come back feeling that any of us were going to be remarkable skiers. Well, that was enjoyable. Apart from that, we saw Iceland from the air, although later I did actually land for a completely different reason in a different aircraft at Houghton on the east side of Iceland. So I flew more across the centre of Iceland, flying from Hofen to Reykjavik, and saw the Vatnajökull and its various features, but only from the air. So in comparing it with, let us say, parts of Scotland, I wouldn't say there was all that much difference. From what I saw, I didn't go to the northern part of the country. We had the usual snowstorms occasionally whilst we were at Reykjavik. I spent most of my year it was a year's tour in Iceland, and I spent most of the year in Reykjavik, actually, rather than Kaldidarnes, because Eventually, whilst we were absent in Greenland, the airfield at Calderanus was flooded because a stretch of water, after receiving a lot of melting snow and being held in place largely by ice, collapsed and completely flooded the airfield, about which I had no first-hand knowledge because we were in Greenland at the time, and when we came back we were based in Greenland for the rest of my tour. We were encouraged to extend the patrols as much as possible because of the losses that the merchant navy was enduring. And on one occasion, when the CO decided to fly with me, and the weather was foul with sudden rising air currents and equally unexpected falls, which made that part of one's anatomy resting on the seat seem to hesitate before following the jolting downward motion, leaving the stomach suspended in between. But the CO was considerate enough to make it clear that he was with us only as an observer, an additional pair of eyes, and any extra vigilance was very welcome on such a day. It really was rough. He positioned himself as a lookout in the Astrodome, which in itself required something of a balancing act. Frequently, being a tall person myself, and he was pretty tall as I remember, your head would be in frequent contact with the top of the Perspex dome. You had to balance yourself. It wasn't a pleasant place to be, and of all, even including, I would think, the tail gunner's position in the turret would be better than standing in that for virtually, or at least trying to stand in it, for virtually the whole of the flight. So one had to take one's hat off to him in doing that in that way. On several occasions he moved unsteadily to the various crew positions. This was probably his undoing. Well, it was Jackie, who was a Cockney, in the rear turret, who first noticed his activity at the small toilet bowl, which had to serve all functional requirements of the human body. When the lid of this bowl was closed, it formed a step into the rear turret and was therefore very much within the rear gunner's range of vision. Jackie lacked none of the raucous Cockney humour, and on the CO's repeated visit to the bowl, Jackie gave a running commentary over the intercom to the rest of us. Owing to his frequent movement from one position to another, the CO was not wearing headphones, and only a Cockney can convey the flavour of Jackie's monologue. But phrases such as, "It's got his head well in," "Oops, his cap's fallen off," "He didn't expect to see that again," "It's not as green as he is," "Get it all in the bowl," and "There can't be any more left," were imprinted on the memory. Knowing that any one of us might have been affected had we not been in relatively stable positions, we sympathised. And sympathy turned to admiration when, half in jest, I asked if I should extend the patrol by 30 minutes out and 30 minutes back, as we had the reserve fuel necessary. And the reply, the seal replied brightly, "Certainly, go ahead, we might be lucky." We were not. We saw nothing but angry sea and sullen sky. And when we landed, we were met at dispersal by the usual Bedford pickup lorry, and out stepped the station commander, an unexpected honour. We followed our CO onto the tarmac, not lined up behind him. He came to attention and saluted. "What sort of a trip did you have?" asked the station commander. "Oh, very good, sir," replied the CO. "What is that on your cap?" The CO doffed his cap and was embarrassed to discover that not all his outpourings had found the appropriate place in the aircraft. Laughter all round healed his pride.
Would the CO fly with all of you in the squadron?
Sorry?
Would the CO fly with all of you in the squadron at one time or another?
I don't really know. So long as he wasn't flying with me all the time, I didn't mind. I think there's a lot of misconstrued remarks made about COs flying or not flying. I think what's easy to forget is that he's got this responsibility for large numbers of aircrew. I don't think, well, I haven't personally met a CO, a squadron CO, who is bureaucratic, and they're very pleased to get rid of any paperwork they can get rid of. And of course, that's what the adjutant's for, and even on some stations, assistant adjutants. But one has to bear in mind that there are these responsibilities as well as leading a group of men in flying. And I think it's too easily forgotten. Not only that, he has a part to play in the compassionate side of leading men, and in particular when condolences are needed for family or whatever. He is the one person who is in direct communication with higher authority. I think it's particularly can be and particularly trying when you're at some distance from the next level of command, let's say a group or even a wing. I mean, in the UK, if there's a real problem and you need a proper discussion with assistance from various quarters, you can go to a group headquarters and have it out. But if you're on your own, in Iceland, although there was a group captain in overall command there, but beyond that, there are these extra responsibilities. And I have not yet met, I say not yet as though I'm going on, I hadn't at this point come in contact with a CO who wasn't doing his job. And I think that it's quite erroneous to think that he can just fly when he pleases. It may be he flew with me on that day because he just had the time. He got rid of a lot of work which he had to do, so let's see who can I fly with, and I'll fly with him, sort of, you know.
Would it be the case he might try, though, and fly with most of his pilots?
He would try to, I think, yes. But I can't give you any affirmative on that, because I was not in the CEO's confidence.
You've mentioned your accommodation at the airbase. What was your messing facilities like there?
Well, as long as we had enough ascorbic acid tablets, we were okay. and that, of course, is to replace the vitamin C that we were short of, because there's no fresh green vegetable. It was as good as we expected. These are things that I don't remember well. I can't give you any sample menu apart from ascorbic acid. And I like the chap who said when we were told by the MO when we first went to Iceland and all about the need to take these a tablet a day, because scurvy is such a nasty disease to have. And he said you take a tablet a day, and some wag said, will they be served in the vegetable tureens? I thought it was very appropriate. So I wouldn't have any. I think that. Let me put it this way, and this is very, very, I don't know how to put it, pointed. When we were in Greenland, we were on American rations. And when we were in Iceland, we were on British rations, which I imagine, and from experience on other stations, were much the same as they were in UK, apart from these things which we knew wouldn't be possible there, like green vegetables. Not that we missed them all, but, you know, I don't think young people really miss their greens. I preferred, and not just from a dietary point of view, but I preferred the British rations. We may have a later opportunity to extol the virtues of American rations in Greenland. But when you think of what was needed as a basic food for members of the forces, and of course members of the public generally, compared with what was offered in the American mess, I don't think one can forget that the above what is basically needed for forces, men and women, to work well at their jobs and to be healthy, the rest is a waste of space and money and possible armaments. So, yes, diet was okay. Oh, yeah, where are we? We finished that bit, actually. That year, Christmas seemed to come early, and it was a rousing occasion after all. While people at home may be thinking of the infrequent event of a white Christmas, we were 99% certain of one. There was only one possible deficiency. The mess committee discerned a lack of beer, and I was detailed to take an aircraft down to Edsel near Aberdeen for a full overhaul and return with a replacement and two extra barrels of beer. So that was a flight well worth making. We had a lovely Christmas dinner, a wonderful intermess, visits going round, and the Met people claimed that they'd kept the day especially for the occasion, because it was a very nice white Christmas. There was an obvious advantage in the fact that Calder was only big enough for one squadron. Well, I was now in the brief habit of a reminiscence at the end of each year. And on the last day of 1942, Johnny, Harry and I summed up the score. The optimism generated by success in North Africa and by the Russians at Stalingrad were tempered by the sense of personal loss. I thought about Tom Mycock and another coincidence. It seemed ironic that after SFTS, and we got our wings, and we'd done so much flying together on Anson's, we'd gone our separate ways in different commands, he to Bomber Command. Yet he apparently spent much of his operational flying against German warships in Brest. And indeed, he was awarded a DFC for doing it, whilst, having had a brief interlude of the same, I had been engaged on a similar mission against the German Navy in the North Atlantic. Well, we neither of us wish to dwell on the sad consequences of war, but those whom we trained, we had trained and were lost. Now half of those I knew at Rissington were not forgotten. In the...
Ted, could I just ask you something about the Christmas period? Although you were celebrating at that period and you weren't flying, would somebody from the squadron be flying on Christmas Day? Would operations continue all
there the would year? Be... Oh, yeah. That applied throughout the service, I think, and certainly throughout my service. There was always a crew ready. May not be detailed, but particularly in our job, I think, because it was Christmas Day or Boxing Day or the day before the day, the whole of that period, the convoys didn't stop their journey. They had to be covered. And so in that sense, Christmas Day was a day like any other. But it was borne in mind, and I think probably more, by the maintenance staff than the flying staff, because there would be an opportunity there for, if we could possibly afford to reduce flying for that period, for some of the aircraft to be brought ready in case we needed any extra patrols or whatever following Christmas.
And I take it would you have New Year's celebrations, or would that be less?
Well, no, I was really referring to the end of the year when I mentioned that we were thinking of the ex-colleagues towards the end of the year, including New Year. It was a time for relaxing as much as possible, a party or two or something like that, but the job was still going on.
I take it with the squadron, though, you made most of your own entertainment being in that situation.
Oh, yes, absolutely, yes. And a lot of the entertainment, of course, came out of a bottle. The only time I remember anyone being really past it as a result of having drunk too much was a wee Scotty, and he was on whiskey or Drambuie, because we got both there, and he felt like dancing, so he got hold of the smoke stack pipe from the stove, which was virtually red hot, and held it as if he were dancing with it, to the extent that he got burned and then collapsed, and we thought that was a little too much.